This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Harvard historian John Stauffer says Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln are the two preeminent self-made men in American history. He says they continually remade themselves and therefore, in his words, exemplified the hope of America. And Stauffer says looking at their struggles provides us with a better understanding of our time. John Stauffer's latest book is a dual biography about these men. It is about Lincoln and Douglass in 19th century America. The title is Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. John Stauffer is our guest in this portion of the program. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. John Stauffer is chair of the history of American civilization and professor of English at Harvard University. In addition to Giants, he is the author of The Black Hearts of Men, Radical Abolitionists and the Transformation of Race, co-author of Meteor of War, The John Brown Story, and editor of Frederick Douglass's My Bondage and My Freedom. His new book, Giants, is published by 12 Books. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. John Stauffer, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, Celeste. It's great to be on the air with you.
In a statement about how this book came to be, you say that as a teenager, you were drawn particularly to the writings of Frederick Douglass. Why?
I moved around a lot. I'd say moving is the central experience of my youth. K through 12th grade, I was in 9 different schools. I was in a different school every year for 6 consecutive years. And amid all those moves, I fell in love with literature and history. And Frederick Douglass and Lincoln both spoke to me in powerful ways. Douglass, it's hard to read both men without being inspired. But especially Douglass's life story really resonated with me. I didn't appreciate or understand race when I was 14 and first read Frederick Douglass, but I understood his grappling with being an outsider and falling in love with words and language and understanding how words can become potent weapons. And I also loved his style even then, even though I didn't understand why. His story, his autobiography was immensely moving, and I've come back to it time and again, and it still inspires me when I teach it to students.
Hmm. Later, you realized Lincoln had also been an outsider. How was
Correct.
Lincoln an outsider?
Lincoln was an outsider for a number of reasons. He was considered poor white trash. That was what most whites and some blacks would have referred to him as. While Douglass was born a slave and had no formal public education, Lincoln had less than a year of formal education. To say that he was born in a log cabin romanticizes it. It was really a three-sided hut. He, too, moved a lot. He was a kind of perennial outsider, and few whites experienced the kind of poverty lowly status that Lincoln did. He also grew up in brutal environments. Lincoln's Indiana, Kentucky, and Illinois backwoods were places in which the defining aspects of manhood was the capacity to drink a lot and fight hard. And Lincoln abstained completely from alcohol and fought, but didn't like fighting. And like Frederick Douglass, as a very young boy, fell in love with words and understood the power of words and that as a source of self-making and self-transformation.
Hmm. We're going to talk a little bit about some fights that these two men got into.
Right.
But before we do that, This book, your book, Giants, was released on November 3rd, 2008.
Correct.
The day before the election.
Correct.
And you chose to open the book with words from Barack Obama, from The Audacity of Hope.
Correct.
So, and in these words from that book, Barack Obama talks about both these men.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I was just going to summarize Barack's words. He refers to Lincoln, Barack Obama has been deeply inspired and influenced by both Douglas and Lincoln, as he reveals in The Audacity of Hope, as well as in many other places, especially his influence of Lincoln. And the one of the points that he makes about his influence, the influence of Douglas on him in Audacity of Hope, is he said that from Frederick Douglass, he essentially learned that power concedes nothing without a fight. And for both Barack Obama and for Frederick Douglass, that fight comes primarily through using words as weapons, although Douglass, because of the violent nature of Douglass's era, he also had to resort to his fists at times. From Lincoln, Barack Obama acknowledges the importance of being pragmatic, of seeking to reach beyond various social divisions for common understanding. And also understanding that on the one hand, we do not know what God wants us to do. On the other hand, acting as though we feel sure that we are in the right. And so that inherent tension is something that Barack understands and appreciates is crucial in a leader. And I would actually go farther than that, and there are places where Barack has as well, by saying that Barack understands through Lincoln, and I think he's displayed it in his own campaign, that the relationship between a leader and the public is something like a dialectic. One needs to understand, have a very good sense of public opinion. I think it was one of Lincoln's, one of the reasons why Lincoln was such a brilliant politician is because he had a brilliant sense of public opinion, and I would say the same thing so far has held true with Obama. But a leader must not only understand public opinion and internalize it, but inspire the public to move toward a common goal. And so there's something of a dialectic there. And that's something that is conveyed in a sense through that quote. There's one other aspect of Frederick Douglass's life and legacy that I think has been crucial to Obama, and that is Douglass was in his own day one of the, probably if not the greatest public speakers, one of the greatest public speakers as reflected by people describing him, as reflected by the fees that he could command as a public speaker. And Douglass spoke in a day in which most whites viewed blacks, at least in theory, as subhuman. And Douglass understood, as he said, the power of art to break down racial barriers. Douglass, when Douglass would stand up on stage and he would speak in his rich, deep baritone voice, and he would sing musical words and provide such rich figures of speech and perform as an artist, whites would see him and they would essentially shed their racism and be converted to his cause. I think Obama has learned a lot from Douglass in that sense. I consider Obama to be one of the great public speakers of his day, and Obama at some level understands that to be a brilliant orator is to break down racial barriers. And there are numerous instances in which whites have gone on record of saying, you know, I can't imagine myself voting for a black man, and then they see and they hear Obama and they vote for him.
Yeah. Do you see Barack Obama as an outsider and a self-made man?
Absolutely. I think Obama has acknowledged as much. He launched his political campaign in Springfield and referred to Lincoln as a self-made man, as a source of inspiration in the speech in which he launched his political campaign. Obama is one of the great self-made men of our time. He was born of a white mother and an African father who deserted the family. His mother had to to resort to welfare at times. He was very fortunate in receiving fellowships or scholarships to go to high school and to college, which was indispensable. Like both Frederick Douglass and Lincoln, Obama early on learned how to use words as weapons, learned the importance of language and literacy in making and remaking the self, learned from both men the power of oratory. It was more important in Douglass and Lincoln's day. In Douglass and Lincoln's day, public speaking was one of the only forms of public entertainment, analogous to being a professional athlete or a rock star or radio music and radio personality today. Obama understands that being a professional athlete, being a musician, is a competing form of public entertainment. But he also understood early on that statistically speaking, the easiest way to rise up is through education and through literacy and through being able to speak and communicate effectively.
What did it mean for Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln to be self-made men? Did they use that term self-made?
Yes, they did. In fact, the very term self-made men was coined in 1832 by Lincoln's hero as a statesman, Henry Clay. Henry Clay first referred to self-made men in a Senate speech in which he is defending himself against Jacksonian Democrats who accused his Whig party of being aristocratic. And he said, not true. Most of the Whigs that I know are self-made men who grew up with very little. One of Frederick Douglass's most famous speeches was a speech called Self-Made Men. He gave it well over 50 times, closer to 100 times. And the nature of the speech wonderfully evolved as he evolved and as the times evolved. So it was a term that was very resonant in their day. Ironically, the term self-made men reached greater popularity after the Civil War, at a time in which the ability to become self-made, to rise up from lowly status, became much more difficult because of the inequalities of wealth. And so there's an irony in the way in which self-making or self-made men becomes immensely popularized at a time in which it's becomes more problematic to do so, in which, in a sense, self-made men becomes more of a myth. In Lincoln and Douglass's day, it was more of a reality, and in that sense, they were lucky to have been born when they were.
Yeah. You say both men understood self-making to be antithetical to racism. At the same time, you note that in the South, slave owning was the surest route to self-making.
Right, right. That's a great point. The difference is that in the South, the quickest way to become a self-made man is to own slaves. And slaves is one of the few commodities that continually increased in value, or virtually did so, over the course of the antebellum era. But the difference was, for a self-made Southerner who rose up through slave owning, the goal was to become rich. The goal was to become rich and respected, and to acquire a certain degree of status. Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln continually said that the goal of self-making was not to get rich. It had nothing to do with material possessions or with wealth. The goal of self-making was to reform your society. The true self-made man devoted himself to social change and to changing his society. That's one crucial difference from self-made men in the South. The second crucial difference is that the way in which Douglass and Lincoln both conceptualized self-making is that they saw the self as being in a continual state of evolution or in flux. So the self never stopped growing. It was never static. And the reason why that conception of self-making contradicts the notion of racism is because racism depends upon the idea of a self that's fixed and static or unchanging. It depends upon the notion that a self being white or having white skin, and that's a permanent condition, and that's superior than blackness or black skin.
Yeah. Well, it's striking to realize that Douglass, as a young man, believed slavery was the source of all wealth. That's where he came from.
That's right.
So Northern whites, in his view as a young man, were impoverished white trash.
Right, right.
So
right.
How was that view transformed? How did that begin to shift?
When it began to shift soon after Douglass became free, ran away and became free and settled in the North. He was 20 years old when he ran away with help from his wife, or then fiance. I argue without the aid of Anna Murray, he probably would not have been able to become free. He first settled with Anna Murray in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and by interacting with whites, working-class whites to wealthy whites in New Bedford, understood the importance and the dignity that came from work. Douglass had grown up in a kind of aristocratic slave South in which a Southern gentleman did not work, and whites who worked, who had to work, who were not slave-owning, were called, as you said, poor white trash. And he quickly came to appreciate the dignity that comes from work, the dignity that comes from needing to earn a living. And Douglass worked. It was nothing if not a workaholic, is the term we'd use today. For the first 2 years after moving to New Bedford, he worked as a manual laborer. In some cases, he said he worked around the clock. He'd work 24 hours, sleep virtually an hour or two or not at all, and then continue to do it. And he was eventually discovered by William Lloyd Garrison as a brilliant public lecturer. And it was at the very first vacation that Douglass took was to attend this abolitionist convention in Nantucket in 1841. And it was there that he was asked to speak. It was the largest audience of whites he had ever spoken to before. And he got up to speak. He said he still felt himself a slave. He gave a brilliant performance. And William Lloyd Garrison, who was widely hailed as one of the great abolitionists, was himself considered a brilliant orator, heard and saw Douglass and said, I want to employ him full time. And so he immediately offered him a full time job as a public lecturer.
Historian John Stauffer is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his latest book, Giants: The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You write about a fight that Douglass had as a 16-year-old with a man named Edward Covey.
Right.
It was a turning point. Who was Covey, and what happened, and what did it mean for Douglass?
Great questions. Well, Douglass was at the eastern shore of Maryland. Douglass, because of changes in his legal ownership, was a return to the eastern shore of Maryland. He was 16 years old. He had already learned how to read and write. His mistress in Baltimore had never been a slave owner before and inadvertently taught Douglass his ABCs until her husband said not to, that the easiest way to destroy a slave was to give him literacy. Douglass heard that and said, if literacy gives slave a power, I'm going to learn how to read. And so Douglass had traded biscuits for words in the streets of Baltimore, practiced writing with chalk on barrels and with flour and on the walls. And so he returns to the Eastern Shore. He feels empowered because he can now read and write. And he looked his new master, Thomas Auld. He was willing to look him in the eyes, willing to talk back to him. And Thomas Auld considered him insolent. That was the term most used to characterize a slave who needed breaking in. And this man, Edward Covey, in the Eastern Shore, was known as a slave breaker. He made very good money by renting out slaves for a year and breaking them in, breaking their will so they would become properly subservient. Thomas Auld loaned out or hired out Frederick Douglass to Covey for a year, and Covey whipped Douglass mercilessly every week, Douglass describes, without fail, for 6 months. Douglass said he had welts on his back that were as thick as his thumb, and the welts had not yet healed when he'd received these new whippings. And finally, after 6 months, he felt himself a brute, felt himself to be like an ox, and decided that he was going to stand up to Covey, even if it cost him his life. He did so. They had this two-hour epic battle. Douglass was even then very disciplined, such that he did not seriously hurt or kill Covey. Douglass was Also fortune in being very big and tall. Douglas was 6'1", in an age in which the average man was 5'7". Covey was about 5'7". And so he conquered Covey, as Douglas said, that Covey was mastered by a boy of 16. Covey never touched Douglas again, never divulged the fight because he didn't want to ruin his reputation as a slave breaker. And from that moment forward, Douglas said that he would define himself as a free man in form, even if he would be a slave in fact. And then from that moment forward, Douglas schemed to run away, and his chief goal was to become free, which he eventually did. It was a crucial turning point in his life, in his very self-conception, and it was the climactic moment, or a crucial climactic moment in each of his three autobiographies. Now, one of the things that I found fascinating is that Abraham Lincoln had a very similar fight that became a crucial turning point in his young life. Lincoln moved to New Salem, Illinois when he was 21 years old, outsider. He had just reached what was called manhood at the time, meaning at age 21, for the first time, Lincoln did not have to turn over every penny to his father. He could do what he wanted. His father was a farmer and a manual laborer and hated the fact that Lincoln liked reading and writing. In fact, there's some evidence that his father beat Lincoln for reading because he thought that was laziness. So Lincoln arrives in New Salem, and the local leader, one of the local leaders, was this man named Jack Armstrong, who was essentially a thug, and he felt threatened by Lincoln because Lincoln is 6'4", so he's literally a giant, physically a giant. And Jack Armstrong was known for luring strangers into poker games, stealing their money, and beating them up. Jack Armstrong was known for roasting a live pig and listening to its sounds of squealing before it died. Armstrong wanted to fight Lincoln in what was known as a rough and tumble, which was a no-holds-barred fight in which it was not uncommon to have a nose bitten off, a finger bitten off, an ear bitten off, testicles ripped out. And one of the great prizes in a rough and tumble was to liberate an opponent's eyeball. It was a brutal fight. Lincoln said, no, I'm not going to fight that. I'm not going to fight you in a rough and tumble. I'll agree to a regulated wrestling match, which the best that we know is that you had to keep an arm on an opponent. The scholar Douglas Wilson has a wonderful analysis of this. They agreed to this regulated wrestling match. People came from all around, which was common in the backwoods. They bet. Lots of bets went around. Armstrong fouled Lincoln. Lincoln called foul. The fight was a draw. No one lost money. Armstrong and Lincoln immediately become friends, and Lincoln is immediately seen and starts to conceptualize himself as a leader in New Salem. In fact, within the year, Lincoln was elected captain of his company in the Black Hawk War, and a few months after that tenure ended, he started his long tenure as a state legislator in Illinois. So that fight was an important turning point for Lincoln to begin to think of himself as a leader. And both these fights were ironic because it was at the very moment in which each man was also conceptualizing himself as intellectuals, as being able to use words and language and books as a crucial source of their identity.
After these two fights, did these two men ever raise their fists again against another?
Douglas did. Both of them did. Lincoln almost got into a duel with a Democratic opponent. It was related to his courtship of Mary Todd. Lincoln met Mary Todd around an 1840 presidential election. Mary Todd was at least as passionate about Whig politics as Lincoln. Both Douglas and Lincoln married up, and Mary Todd grew up next to Henry Clay's estate in Kentucky. Mary Todd was, as I said, at least as passionate about Whig politics, and she ended up advising Lincoln along the way to the White House. And they first came together around this 1840 political campaign, and one of their shared opponents was this Democrat in Illinois, and Lincoln, and both Mary Todd and Lincoln wrote these horribly satirical letters which threatened the honor of this Democrat who challenged Lincoln to a duel. And they got so far as to go to their destination. Dueling was illegal in Illinois, and they went to this essentially an island on the Mississippi River, technically in Missouri. And Lincoln, as the recipient of the challenge, was able to choose weapons, and he chose broadswords, which are fairly barbaric large swords, but Lincoln knew that he could use his long arms as an advantage. And the duel court that Lincoln fashioned was essentially like a tennis court with a net, not a net, but a board. And Lincoln said that if you stepped outside, that you forfeited your life. And they both met to proceed with the duel until friends intervened. That's the closest that Lincoln had to continuing to use his brawn. Frederick Douglass did on a number of occasions. He was one time walking in New York City and with a white woman who was his, helped him edit a newspaper, Julia Griffiths, and was knocked flat, essentially blindsided with a fist by a white man and had to defend himself. Douglass was a close friend of John Brown, and after John Brown failed in his attempt to raid Harper's Ferry with some blacks and whites and was hung, Douglass had a commemorative meeting for John Brown in Boston, and the meeting was attacked by a number of whites, and it turned into an all-out brawl in which Douglass where he had to defend himself. Probably the most prominent example is when Douglass was a full-time paid public lecturer for the American Anti-Slavery Society, this abolitionist, large abolition society. They went west and they reached Pendleton, Indiana. And there were a number of white thugs in Pendleton, Indiana, people that were not that unlike Jack Armstrong. And they attacked this abolition meeting. And one of Douglass's close friends at the meeting was attacked. And Douglass thought he might be getting killed. And so he intervened and picked up a club and ran after one of these thugs or the leaders. And for that, one lifting a weapon against a white man cut against every known rule in antebellum society, and suddenly every white there was after Douglass and wanted to kill him. And the only reason that Douglass did not die is that this friend that he was trying to save, turns out, had not gone down and came out of nowhere and protected Douglass. But Douglass still had his hand broken.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian John Stauffer, author most recently of Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You open Giants with a wonderful prologue. As you open the story, Frederick Douglass is arriving in Washington, D.C. on a muggy summer night in 1863.
Right.
How was the war progressing at the time?
At the time, from Douglass's perspective, the war was progressing much better than it had the first couple of years, because in January of 1863, with the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln finally realized that he needed blacks on the side of the Union in order to win the war. And that effectively opened the way for recruiting blacks in the North to fight for the Union. And so from beginning in January, Douglass devoted full time to recruiting blacks. And in fact, he almost single-handedly recruited the famous Massachusetts 54th. His two sons were two of his first recruits. He went to Washington because in August he was very frustrated with Union policy toward blacks. Blacks were being paid half of what white soldiers were, and they were not being promoted. And so Douglass, even though he didn't have a meeting scheduled with Lincoln, took a train to Washington, D.C. He arrived on August 10th in the morning, and he was hoping that he might be able to see the president to let him know of his complaints and to see what would happen. He arrives at the White House in the morning. There's already a long line of whites waiting to see Lincoln. Lincoln was known as having a kind of open door policy, letting in all callers. Douglass stands in line. He thinks he's going to have to wait all day, maybe two. He sends up his card. Lincoln already knows Douglas and calls him in. And so Douglas walks up these steps to Lincoln's office, passing a number of whites who are outraged that a black man is being let through. And when Lincoln first sees Douglas, they had never met, but Lincoln's first words were, "Hello, Mr. Douglas, it's good to see you. I know you. What can I do for you?" And Douglas told Lincoln about his complaint. And they had a relatively long meeting. Douglas understood that Lincoln did not agree with him politically. Douglas, from the beginning of his career, really, was always a radical, revolutionary. Douglas's chief goal in life was the immediate end of slavery and racial equality. Those were his chief goals. Lincoln's chief goal as president was to end the war and preserve the Union. That was the oath of office he took. That was his chief goal. But by their first meeting in 63, they understood that they needed each other, that Douglas needed Lincoln to help him end slavery immediately and to try to achieve some semblance of racial equality. And Lincoln had understood that he needed Douglas, who was the ambassador of African Americans. Without the aid of Douglas, it would be very difficult to recruit blacks to put them to the best use of the Union forces to defeat the South. And so that shared understanding that they needed each other, I think, is one of the things that brought them together and made them see in each other a friendship, even though they never disagreed politically. Another important aspect of that first meeting is they both, in after that first meeting or during that first meeting, actually had great respect for each other as self-made men. They both still contained or had resonances of their old accents. In the book, I convey what Douglas and Lincoln actually sounded like as young men and how over the course of their rise, they shed some of the profound or pronounced aspects of their accent. Although in 1863, Lincoln had still had a much more pronounced accent than Frederick Douglass did. But the fact that they had resonances of this accent, I think they appreciate each other's self-making. And in fact, the very next person that President Lincoln saw after his meeting with Douglass, he said, "I just met with Frederick Douglass. I consider him one of the most meritorious, if not the most meritorious men in these United States." And Douglass said to a friend, "I think of Lincoln as the king of self-made men." So there is this mutual respect for each other as self-made men. And Douglass, after that first meeting, said to another friend that Lincoln was one of the few white men who treated him as a man, not as a black man, which is a profound statement given that Lincoln did not even share Douglass's radicalism. But because of his self-making, he was able to overcome or to shed the kind of racism that was so pervasive in American society at the time.
Let's take a call now. We have a listener ready to talk with us in Champaign County on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I was interested in you recounting. I already heard you on another show in the meeting. I think in the other, you emphasized that he had actually known him by reading his printed speeches, I guess, mainly, right?
Correct. Frederick Douglass, as a newspaperman, first referred to Lincoln as early as 1848, and when Lincoln was a congressman. So Douglass wrote a lot about Lincoln over the course of the 1850s, and we have very good evidence that Lincoln had read Frederick Douglass. In fact, during the 1850s, Douglass was much more famous than Lincoln. Lincoln did not become a nationally known figure until 1860, till the presidential campaign, and Douglass was a household name by the late 1840s.
He was mixed. Was he a product of a slave owner? Or?
That's very good. Douglass never knew who his father was. His father was a white man. He suspected that it was a master, either Aaron Anthony or Thomas Auld, but he was never sure. It's something that bothered him a lot, particularly as he grew older, and a slave mother. And I argue that there's good evidence that Douglass was right in thinking that one of his masters was his father, because Douglass grew up as a privileged slave. Douglass tried to escape once before he successfully fled, and instead of sending him south into Alabama, or whipping him virtually to death, as most masters would have done. His master, Thomas Auld, said, instead, "I'll give you your freedom at age 21. That was almost unheard of, I mean, which suggests that there was a familial a relationship there.
Yeah. I wanted to ask a little bit about Lincoln. I always get in trouble because I cite the book Forced into Glory.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty controversial here in the land of Lincoln, and
right.
It's a bestseller in the African-American community, and
right.
I was pretty persuaded, having seen him and read parts of the book, but the point I wanted to get to was, I heard you use a quote from Lincoln where he basically claimed himself as a victim, a person who, you know, was forced, was in a position where he had to act in the way that he did. He didn't feel like... Do you remember the quote?
Yeah, I mean, Lincoln famously said that events controlled him. He didn't control events. And I think that... I mean, you're referring to Leroy Bennett's book on Forced into Glory, where he argues that Lincoln is a representative American racist. That's, you know, kind of a main theme of the book. And I mean, that's a line that Frederick Douglass had said of Lincoln in 1861 and as late as 1862, that he was a racist because of his policies. Lincoln, I mean, I agree with Bennett in the sense that Lincoln was a conservative Republican. Lincoln was never a revolutionary. He was never a radical in the way that Frederick Douglass was. I mean, he never presented himself as such. As a conservative Republican, it meant, what did that mean? It meant that he hated slavery. And Lincoln frequently said he hated slavery as much as the most radical of abolitionists. And there's no reason to doubt that. But his conservatism hinged on how you go about ending slavery. For Frederick Douglass, as a radical abolitionist, the way to end slavery is to do it immediately. And if you uproot society, so be it. If it causes some violence, so be it. If it causes the death of some white slave owners, so be it. But as a radical abolitionist, slavery constitutes a state of war, and I'm a peacemaker, and so I'm going to end slavery to bring about the peace. And if there are deaths brought about in ending slavery, so be it. We're already living in civil war. That was Douglass's perspective. Lincoln believed, and here he followed closely on the Founding Fathers. He believed that slavery should end very gradually, very congenially, so as to not uproot society. In his debates with Stephen Douglas, Lincoln said that when is my vision of ultimate emancipation? He said, not less than 100 years. That would put it at 1958. What I think is so fascinating and important to appreciate about Lincoln is that he was a conservative Republican, or as a politician, another way to phrase it, he was a centrist, who effectively presided over a revolutionary transformation of the United States. And he was at the helm of this revolutionary transformation. What do I mean by revolutionary transformation? In 1860, very few, no more than 7 or 8% of Americans believed in universal freedom and in racial equality. Only a self-described radical abolitionist believed that, and they constituted no more than 7-8%. By 1865, most Northerners believed in universal emancipation and in varying degrees believed in at least citizenship or some semblance or some greater degrees of equality between blacks and whites. The very platform of the Republican Party, the central platform of the Republican Party in the 1864 election was 13th Amendment. Universal emancipation. That's a radical change in American culture and society, and Lincoln, as the president, presides over it. And he was right in saying events controlled him. To his credit, and one of the reasons why he's such a brilliant politician and president, is that he understood the direction in which the nation was moving. He was, especially in Douglass's formulation, too tardy. He was not radical enough. But to his credit, he understood the direction, understood that his role was to prevent a kind of counter-revolution, prevent this revolutionary moment from having this profound backlash and losing all of its gains.
Is the caller still there?
Sure, yeah. What do you make of the argument that he, Lincoln and others who were in this category, conservative Republicans, which has a completely different meaning than the now,
right.
Were opposed slavery because of what it did to the dominant society. You already sketched out the aristocratic
right.
And, I mean, it devalued work in a way, and all of that. But also, I wanted to get you, and then I'll hang up, to comment on the repatriation concept that Lincoln had. Thank you. I'll listen off here.
No, those are great questions. Lincoln also, and this was true of most anti-slavery, conservative anti-slavery advocates, they believe that not only in gradual emancipation, but they believed in colonization. As Lincoln said, he had a hard time envisioning blacks living in the United States as equals. So he advocated colonizing them in another country. Just about every black considered that, or the vast majority of blacks saw that as racist. That was part of that conservative vision for ending slavery. Lincoln's hatred of slavery had multiple sources. He believed that it made it more difficult for whites to earn a living, because if you're competing with slave owners for work within a marketplace, slave owners have an advantage. He believed that slavery adulterated the dignity of free white labor. But he also, and he said this, there are numerous examples of this, believed that slavery was a moral evil. And he believed in fact, he said in one snippet that every animal, from the birds and the bees and the ants, understood that they had the right to their own labor, and that was what he considered that a natural law, which is built into the Constitution, which the best way to summarize natural law is that it was God's law.
Hmm. We're coming down here rapidly now on our time, the time we have left in this portion of the program. I want to fast forward to 1876.
Right.
And the unveiling of the Freedmen's Statue.
Right.
And this has become quite a controversial statue.
Right.
And when it was unveiled, this statue designed by Charles Ball, Douglas did not like it.
No.
But what did he say that day?
He was asked to give the keynote speech at the statue. He actually that day did not. He had enough tact to say to avoid saying, this is a horrible statue. He thought it put the statue itself paternalistic, though, because it was a kneeling slave. Mm. And Lincoln stands above the slave with one hand on the Emancipation Proclamation, the other hand blessing the slave. It harkens back to a iconic image in the anti-slavery movement, the kneeling slave who is supplicating to God, but there's also a paternalistic aspect in which, for many white abolitionists, supplicating or praying to whites for their freedom, which is one of the reasons why Douglas didn't like it. And the statue is the slave is supplicating to Lincoln. But in the speech, I think it is one of the best assessments of Lincoln on race and slavery and ultimately his legacy. Douglas begins his speech by saying that Lincoln was the preeminent white man's president. He said, "We blacks are his stepchildren at best." Mm-hmm. Why? Because Lincoln's chief aim was the preservation of the Union, the end of the war. We were byproducts. We were his stepchildren. And then Douglas embarks on this classical reversal. He was famous for this in speeches. Riling his audience, and the audience that he spoke to then, it was the President Grant was there, the most of Congress was there, the Supreme Court was there. These are some of the most preeminent white dignitaries in the nation. Douglas, after saying that Lincoln is the preeminent white man's president, we are best his stepchildren, concludes by saying that we are also part of his children, that we are part of the American family, because one of the reasons why Lincoln was a great president is he understood that even though he initially might have seen us as stepchildren, in order for him to accomplish his goal, we needed to become his children. He could not win the war otherwise. And the duty that he promised to take as president was one of preserving the Union. That he never vowed to be a black man's president, and so he did everything that he was supposed to do as president. We were his stepchildren, but because of the events of the war, we became part of the national family. And it's a brilliant speech that both acknowledges Lincoln's conservatism on slavery and race, and also acknowledges how he presided over, as I said, this radical transformation. What was ironic is that Frederick Douglass gave the speech in 1876 at the very end of Reconstruction, in which, in one sense, 1876 can be seen as the year that the South finally wins the Civil War. And Douglass said nothing about all of the paramilitary violence against blacks and Republicans that had been occurring throughout the South for the past 10 years.
Hmm. I've got one last question, and I can give you about 30 seconds, a minute.
Okay.
Would it be useful to take a look at other lives of self-made political actors, like these two men, and take a look at their time and place and their struggles? Here I'm thinking of Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great, great example. In fact, I'm working on a larger book on interracial friendship as a symbol of democracy. And this book, I say in my acknowledgments, that the Giants really began as a chapter in this larger project. And because Douglass and Lincoln's stature, they threatened to overwhelm the rest of the book, and I, for a variety of reasons, I wanted to publish as a book. But in my original conception, Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King Jr. are the 20th century successors of Douglass and Lincoln. Both were indispensable to each other. They were very different, yet they came to see each other as friends. Both Martin Luther King was a crucial advisor to Johnson. Both of them came together during a period in which they faced a shared enemy, a common enemy. It was the, in both cases, it was white supremacist, especially white Southerners, but white supremacists more generally. I think it's a wonderful 20th century parallel that is a way of showing how some of the tensions and the issues related to self-making in the 20th century persist from the 19th century, both as it relates to race and as it relates to understandings of our nation.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. John Stauffer, thank you very much for talking with us this
afternoon.
Thank
you, Celeste. Thanks.
John Stauffer is the author of Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. This is his most recent book. It is published by 12 Books.